Alrighty, so last week we left off in verse 21 of chapter 18. So I thought I'd just do a quick recap here to get our minds back into where we were before. And then we'll try to get through the rest of 18 and most of 19 today. But I'm always overly optimistic, so we probably won't get that far. So as you recall, chapter 18 paints this picture of intimacies of divine fellowship with the Lord. And in that, we find kind of the structure for the chapter in what I call four perquisites or benefits or bennies that we experience when we are in intimate fellowship with the Lord. The first we found in verses 1 to 8, and that is that we enjoy God's fellowship. The second we found in verses 9 to 15, and that is we receive God's blessings. And the third we found in 16 to 21, is that we begin to hear God's inner thoughts. Now, this is where I think the chapter gets very interesting, beginning in verse 16 and through the end of the chapter. So we left off last week with God letting Abraham in on his thinking. He has this little soliloquy, as I called it last week, in verses 17 to 19, where he's kind of thinking out loud, and he allows Abraham to listen in on his reasoning. Now, God is reasoning through this idea of whether or not he is going to let Abraham in on what he's about to do at Sodom and Gomorrah. And as Abraham and we listen in, we see something about how the divine mind works. You remember that God gives us several reasons as to what he's thinking about in terms of informing him, and this is going to kind of lead us into what we're going to see for this week. So having decided that Abraham should know and sharing these reasons why, then he reveals his plan in verses 20 to 21, which then leads us to the final benefit of intimate relationship with the Lord, which, if you remember from our outline last week, is this idea of having God's ear. So the final benefit of our intimate relationship with God is we have his ear. Now, I've got to say, sometimes the South Campus benefits by you going first. This week, you benefit by them going first, because they changed a lot in these last sections as I went back through it and realized, boy, this is confusing. So I'm going to have to go back and unconfuse them when I get down to this morning. So we'll look at this final chapter. And as I mentioned to you last week, to me, these last two sections are really fascinating in terms of what's going on. So I asked you to think about it. I know you guys all went home and did your homework, but it just occupied your brains all week. So what is, in fact, going on in verses 22 to 23? What's happening in these final verses as we talk about having God's ear? Any thoughts? Don't everybody speak at once. I got to know who's...
Trying to save Lot.
Okay. Trying to save Lot. Possibly. I think there's a bit more than that going on. But certainly... we see some of that. Any other thoughts?
Abram's interceding, pleading for them to come into righteousness.
Okay, we're starting to get a little closer there. We're seeing intercession going on here. Okay, and indeed, that's what else we see. Most commentators do focus in on that. But I think there's something really quite a bit more that's happening here. And that is that Abraham is exploring God's nature by probing his mind. Okay, he's exploring God's nature. What he wants to know in particular, I think, is how God's justice works. Now think about it for a minute. Just go back and look at verses 17 to 19. Okay, look at what he said back here. Okay, so they rose up, they went. The Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations are going to be blessed." Okay, so God's first thought is, look, he's my man. I better make sure I let him in on what I'm doing. Okay, and then he goes on. He gives us some more reasons. For what? Chosen, we talked about that. I have known him, again, reasons, so that he may command his children and his household after him, what? To keep the way of the Lord. Then what comes next? By doing righteousness and justice. Okay, doing righteousness and justice. And therefore, I can bring all the blessings to him that I want to. So, Abraham has been listening in on this conversation, as I mentioned last week. So, I think it is occurring to Abraham, okay, Now, God commands me to righteousness and justice, and he's just told me he's going to go wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. There must be some believers there. I wonder how God works out his justice when he thinks through things. And I think this is what Abraham is doing as he moves into these last verses here. He is probing God's mind to understand how God's justice actually works. Now, yeah.
But I'm just thinking as you read that, 17 to 19 is almost God's invitation to Abraham to do that.
Right. So if it's his invitation, so if God invites you to do something, right? What would be in my mind would be, okay, God, well, how do I do that? Right? So, yeah, it really is interesting. And that's the part that I saw when I went back and looked at it even again, thinking about it for this week. I mean, it is an invitation to do those things. It's a reminder. It's kind of a reinforcement of what he's been telling him all along, an invitation to do these things rightly. And Abraham's going to probe, how do I do that? Now, what's different about this communication in verse 23? What's different about the pattern? Just look for the obvious. Okay, who starts the conversation this time?
Abraham.
Abraham. Okay, that's the first time we've seen that. So Abraham initiates the conversation with God. Right? Everything up till now, it's been, hey, Abraham! Yes, Lord, here I am. Okay, now Abraham initiates the conversation. Again, it's not a big deal, but I think we just continue to see this growing relationship that Abraham has with the Father.
He also came near.
Came near, right. Yeah, the whole idea, right? Came near. Now, what do we see about in most of the Old Testament when you come near a holy place?
Yeah,
take your shoes and hit the dirt. Right? Okay. So, interesting. You know, I mean, we see the intimacy of Abraham's relationship here with the Lord. Now, you guys did focus on something that most commentators do focus on, and they kind of really zero in on this idea of it being an intercessory prayer. And I can't disagree with that, okay? So in the sense that he is both talking to God and he's interceding for the righteous, you know, it's not entirely wrong. We do see aspects of intercessory prayer here, and I think we can take that away as an implication. But as I said, I think it misses the main point, which is this idea of how Abraham's relationship has progressed. Okay, it's progressed to the point now that God allows him to probe his mind. Now, this is interesting, right? We have all these questions, don't we? Like, how does free will and God's sovereignty work? And how does the Trinity work? And how is he man and God at the same time? I mean, I got all these questions. I'd love to be able to ask God. I do, you know, we do through prayer today. He hasn't chosen to enlighten me with anything different than what's in his word already. It tells me to live with the tension, which is what we have to do. But God's letting him ask questions. I think that's pretty cool. Okay, he's going to let him go. He's probing him with these series of questions that is going to appeal to God's character. Okay, he wants to understand more about God's essential nature. Now, what attributes does he appeal to? What attributes? Think of theological attributes of God. What does he appeal to?
Mercy.
Okay. Actually, that's a trap question, because no, that's not exactly what he doesn't appeal to.
Justice.
He appeals to his justice. Okay. So, in fact, God's justice, and now specifically his remunerative justice, and I'll explain that in just a second, but I also think he's kind of probing a little bit about God's long-suffering as well, right? Well, God, how about 50? Yeah, 50, okay. What about 45? What about so-and-so? What about so-and-so? God's long-suffering, basically, is his withholding his judgment when he should otherwise, you know, inflict his judgment. So he's kind of trying to get a sense of, okay, God, how are you going to work this out, number one? Number two, how long? I mean, and how many, really, is the question he's asking. Now, he cuts him off at 10, right? When we get to 10 at the end, I expect if God had let him go on down to 1, God would have said, yeah, if there was just 1, I would do that. Now, hold on to the idea here, okay? Because we're going to learn something about God also when we get to chapter 19. So, his justice and his long-suffering. Now, what attributes are not? Okay, go ahead, Andre.
I feel too silly to say that, sorry. I think everybody heard.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, but grace or mercy. Okay, I'm not picking on Andre. I appreciate people when they're willing to share from the point of view. But yeah, he doesn't appeal to his grace and mercy. because, you know, he's going after something different in the process. Now,
well, can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
What's the difference then between how you explain long-suffering and mercy?
Long-suffering, they're slightly different things, and they're all in the same attribute of God. So if you look at a theological designation, the category is God's goodness. God's goodness has four characteristics in it. It has his love, his grace, his mercy, and his long-suffering. So it's a fair question. They're a bundle of things that go together. Each gets at a slightly different thing. Long-suffering is specifically God withholding judgment, okay, when people are continually disobedient. Okay, so it's just drawing out a specific aspect of it. The mercy is the actual action, okay, in the process. Okay, so there's kind of a slight distinction in the two things there. This is what theologians come up with when they do theology. They find these little differences in there, okay? So God's grace and mercy in the process. Now, in fairness, and this is what I want to say, because we had exactly the same question last week. In fairness to what he said, I do believe these are surely on his mind, okay? Clearly, we've seen enough about Abraham's character to know that he wants to intercede for people in his grace and mercy. What did he do with Lot when they had to divide up the land? He said, hey, Lot, you pick first. You know, he had no reason to give Lot that privilege, but he did anyway. But I think he primarily wants to know how God's working out his justice in this situation. So the narrative proceeds with Abraham's persistent appeals, right? Each time he ups the ante by lowering the number. Okay, so I think he really is trying to genuinely understand. What I'm trying to also point out is I don't think he's haggling here. Okay, now ancient Near East people, they haggled. Okay, Eastern people haggle. If my wife was here, she would confirm. They haggle. Okay, we deal with it a lot differently here in the West. Okay, it's just normal in terms of their communications pattern. Rather, I think he's again probing and appealing to the very thing that he was just invited, using Linda's language, to do back in verses 17 and 19, right? I want you to keep my ways by doing righteousness and justice, okay? So we see the process playing out. Now, Abraham wants to learn how to judge rightly. So who would this remind you of? What other major Old Testament figure wanted to judge rightly when God asked him what he wanted? Solomon, right? King Solomon, right? Hey, you can give anything you want. Well, I'm just a young pup. I don't know how to go in and go out. So please help me to judge rightly. Okay, so Abraham is taking it rather seriously in the process. So we get to the end here. Abraham may have started the conversation. By the time we get to 10, God said, look, he's had enough. He's certainly learned what my mind is. I do expect if he'd have gone down to 1, it would have been 1. And he cuts off the conversation and it closes. Okay, so pretty interesting process there, which then leads us to chapter 19. So, questions? Yeah.
I was looking at this conversation that God had with Abraham before he's revealed to him what he's going to do. He talked about Abraham being his chosen one and righteousness and justice and doing what's right. And then he goes to Sodom and Gomorrah. It's almost like, you get a blessing if you do what I'm telling you.
Right.
But here's the consequences if you don't.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Exactly right.
Because you got a group of people that weren't doing what was right.
Yeah.
He's going to show them, here's the consequences. You got the blessing if you get to do what's right. Here's what happens if you don't.
Yeah.
I think there's a lesson to it.
There's definitely a lesson there, and there's also a question we're going to have to answer, which is, he said he was going to not blow Sodom and Gomorrah up if there were any righteous. He did blow it up, didn't he?
Yeah.
There were some righteous ones. So how do we work that one out? Okay, so we're going to have to take a look at that when we get through here, right? So he does do that in the process. But yeah, exactly right. I think you're right. We're going to see that. Sue?
Wouldn't you say maybe Jonah would be another one that was kind of probing God, but from the other perspective, where
sure,
he was like, bring it down on them? He didn't want them to be.
Yeah, you got the whole Nineveh thing, right? So I would say Nineveh's probably, you know, Jonah comes at it from a different angle, as you correctly note. He doesn't want God. He knows what God's willing to do. Right? And he wants to run away from it.
Yeah.
Right? But then God says, no, you can't run from me. But he brings it back. But yeah, we see that on a much grander scale, right? And then when you get to Nahum, the minor prophets, you see after God withholding his justice for about long-suffering, again, for about 100 years, right? The Ninevites, after having responded to Jonah, go right back to their wicked ways, whoosh, comes in and wipes them out in the process, okay? So, you know, you do see the kind of things. But yeah, I think we see a similar thing with Jonah, certainly on a grander scale in that process. Okay, so I've called this chapter a monument to God's justice, because Sodom and Gomorrah hereafter in the Bible is always going to be referred to, as Jim noted, the place to look to when you ain't doing what God wants you to do, right? Look, at if you're going to persist in sin, look at what I'm willing to do if you are not going to follow my ways in the process. Okay, so monument to justice. Obviously the sequel to 18, 16 and following. We see first God's inspection according to his stated purpose. All right, he says he's going to go down and take a look. Okay, so the angels go down and take a look. He confirms what he's going to do, followed by his justice in the aftermath. Now again, four kind of distinct acts, if you will, to this narrative. The first one pictures debauchery in the first 11 verses. So we do see the depth of sin, the outcry that God had heard. Then in verses 12 to 22, we see deliverance. Okay, how God delivers, and this is where we're going to get to how he deals with his promise, right? The righteous among the unrighteous. Thirdly, we're then going to see destruction, obviously, the actual act of God implementing his justice. And if that wasn't enough, the chapter is going to end with disgrace, right? So you see these kind of four things as we work our way through chapter 19. Now, what is the main point of chapter 19? What's the main point? Not a tricky one. Just look for the obvious. The main point.
Explain God's justice.
Yeah, absolutely. Primarily to demonstrate God's response to unrepentant sin. Okay? God will deal with sin. Period. Okay? It may take longer for him to deal with it than we might think in our human minds, but God's going to deal with sin. Secondarily, it's going to be to demonstrate how God preserves the righteous who are among the unrighteous. Okay? Abraham framed his question as, will you destroy all of them for the sake of the righteous? God basically said, no, I'll protect the righteous. He didn't commit, okay? And we're going to see that his mind and his methods are a little different in the process. Now, what attribute of God do we learn about? We've been through this. His justice, okay? And specifically here, it's sometimes called his righteousness. But let me just explain again how this is grouped. In theological systems, they have God's attributes. They talk about his communicable properties and his uncommunicable properties. So the uncommunicable properties are ways that we're absolutely not like God. Communicable properties are ways that we have some resemblance to God's attributes and characteristics. Now, within the category of holiness and justice, we deal with two things. First of all, God's holiness is what? Just a simple definition. What is it? What's God's holiness?
Separation
from what?
Sin.
What?
Sin.
Right. Exactly right. Okay, so he's completely, entirely separate, distinct, has no part in, can have nothing to do with sin. It's his absolute goodness, you know, everything else that goes with that. It's his holiness, right? Talk about his majestic holiness, that's his transcendence, and then they talk about his separateness from sin. Now, paired to that is his justice, okay? So kind of like as I just explained to Andre a minute ago, holiness is his essence, his character. Justice is how he implements his holiness, okay? So within justice, there are actually two things. There's his moral justice, and that is his setting of the moral law, okay? So that's God giving us what his standards are in the process. Then there's the working out of that, which is called his distributive justice, and it has two parts, okay? So God's justice has two parts. It has what's called his retributive justice. That's what God does when you don't obey, right? And then he has his remunerative justice. That's reward when you do obey. So remember, there's two sides to God's justice, okay? There's both punishing for disobedience, and then there is reward for obedience, okay? So that's what I'm talking about here. Both his retributive and his remunerative justice are on display. We're going to see how he rewards the righteous, and we're going to see how he punishes the unrighteous in the process. Okay, so any questions on that? Just for the record, I hated theology in seminary. It's important, and it's ironic, because the first thing we taught when we went to China was theology, and I was like, ah, I hated that. Why aren't we doing this first? It is important, okay? Sometimes the definitions get a little crazy, but when you think about it, it's really trying to basically, in this case, help us to understand who God is, right? So in theology proper, which is the theology of God, we're really answering two questions. Does he exist, and what's he like? Okay, that's what you're answering in that theological branch of systematic theology. So this is, what is he like? Now, how is God's remunerative justice displayed in this case? How is his, remember, this is the reward side of justice. How does he display it?
He rescues Lot.
Exactly right, okay. He rescues imperfect Lot, right? And his family or his family members, right? Reminding us that God may reveal his mind, but not always his methods, okay? So he pretty much told Abraham that he wouldn't punish the righteous for the unrighteous. He didn't exactly tell him how he was going to do that. And that's what he does differently here. Okay, what does he do? Does he withhold judgment on the unrighteous? No. What does he do? He carves the righteous out. Okay, and he takes them away. And then, how many righteous were left? Answer is none. Right? Okay, so therefore God is, you know, consistent with what he said. Okay, there were none there, so I'm going to go destroy them for what they did. So, he rescues imperfect Lot. He did spare the righteous. He just didn't do it the way that Abraham had envisioned, right? So just think about it in your own walk with the Lord. I mean, I do it all the time. If I was ever picked as a handicapper, I mean, I'd be horrible. I mean, I'd be worse than a weatherman, right? I always got it figured out, well, this has got to be the way God's going to work this one out. And of course, you know, it's rarely correct. Rarely, rarely correct. And when it is correct, it's only a little bit correct. So the fact of the matter is that God doesn't tell us how he's going to do things. He just tells us what it is, what his character, and what he will do. So we see that in display here. All right, somebody read the first 11 verses for me of chapter 19. Come on, where's some man voices? Somebody step up here.
The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in at the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go to your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the town square." But he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked them leavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you, and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." Then they pressed hard against the man Lot, and drew near back the door down. But the men reached out with their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out, groping for the door.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. All right, so as with 18:1, we start with identity of the men who came, their angels. Now, what is interesting about where the angels find Lot? What is interesting about where they find him?
Sitting at the gate.
What does that mean? Yeah, yeah, okay. So he was sitting at the gate. Why is that significant? Well, Lot has gone from pitching his tent near Sodom, right, to living in Sodom, right, now to being among the leaders of Sodom, right? So remember the progression here with Lot. It's reminding us that sinful living is alluring and it is numbing, right? When you get yourself around sin, you start to become numbed to the process and you get sucked in. So he's now a leader in this wicked city. So he offers a similar but less enthusiastic greeting in 2 and 3. He extends lodging and refreshment. And we don't see any bit of Lot's wife in this process, which is kind of interesting. So maybe a precursor to what's going to happen to her in the process. But what's notable about verse 4? What do we see about verse 4? So go ahead, Dennis, read verse 4 again. I liked your rendering. That's an ESV you're reading from?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house.
All right. So what's interesting about this verse?
They're all corrupt.
They're all corrupt. Absolutely. Look for the obvious answer. The total depravity of Sodom, right? Young and old, all of them. I mean, he couldn't have said it more clearly. He kept repeating himself in the process. So the entire city was unrighteous, right? I think this is important, right? Because God said he wouldn't destroy them if there were any righteous. We're establishing the fact that, indeed, the city is totally depraved. The men make their intentions known in verse 5. And so why are these two verses important? I've already said, because they confirm the fact or the evidence of the outcry that God had been hearing about this city. Okay, so, of course, God knew this was the case. He didn't have to figure it out, but he's bringing us into the story as we go. Now, in verses 6 to 8, Lot intercedes for his guests, as you would expect him to do. What would you say about his intercession?
A bit strange.
What's that?
A bit strange.
A bit strange, yeah, horrible. I think those are all good. Here's the thing, he starts well, right? He does start well. His intention is to protect his visitors, right? But his solution, I just use the kind word dubious, okay? It's dubious at best, right? If not out like crazy, right? So it is dubious. So what are the implications that you might draw from his actions? What kind of implications would you draw about that if you were standing up here preaching and tried to kind of draw out some implications?
He was living the same life of sin that Sodom was.
Yeah, he certainly was, right? Okay, specifically what else? Yeah, yeah, interesting. Okay.
His reputation.
Yeah.
His family, because there's a certain obligation.
Yeah.
To protect your guests.
Uh-huh. Yeah, interesting. I think those are all good suggestions. And the reputation I hadn't thought about, because that is clearly what he was being Christ. So avoiding sin with sin is never the right answer. Okay? So he did have an obligation in ancient Near East society to protect his guests, right? But he also reveals, and now that I think about it here, I think it also, what's another implication? It reveals what God thinks, I mean, what Lot thinks about God, right? So what does he do? Does he pray? Does he ask the Lord to intervene? No, he resorts to human measures, right? And again, I'm not going to hit him too hard. I do it all the time, too. I think I've shared a number of times. In my own growth, I'm certain I didn't begin to grow until I stopped thinking in my old business mind, right? 30 years, did that stuff. Seemed to work pretty good. I said, well, yeah, this must be the way you do it. I'm just going to layer a little spirituality on top of that, and it's all fine. No, not at all. Not even close. Okay, so you got to start thinking biblically in the process and thinking through Scripture. We had the men's meeting yesterday morning, and that really was the topic of it, which is how do you wash your mind constantly in the Word? How do you think through biblical principles and think through biblical standards in terms of how you approach things in your life? And it really is what's happening. So don't be cavalier about those who God entrusts to us. Now, what does verse 9 also tell us about Lot?
He's not righteous?
Well, no, actually, it's just the opposite a little bit. He does have some redeeming qualities, okay? Because obviously the city didn't like him very much. They said, who's this guy? Showed up, did this, and now he's our judge. Okay, so we do see kind of some of the redeeming aspects of Lot's character.
I'll take what it says over in the New Testament about Lot, that Lot was a righteous man.
Yeah.
And he was distressed in his righteous soul,
right,
by the lawless deeds that he saw and heard.
Right.
He knew the difference between good and evil.
Right.
And I was just thinking, as we were looking at this, where was the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah coming from?
Mm.
It might well have been coming from Lot.
Yeah, could have been.
He doesn't identify him, but if he was distressed,
mm-hmm.
about what was going on there. Somebody had to be saying something.
Yeah.
They knew the difference.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we go to 2 Peter, was it 2:9 or something where that is? I mean, I always have a struggle with this guy Lot. I mean, you know, where is he righteous? But it
that's
clearly says.
Too, you know,
what's that?
There's Samson too and a few other ones.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, clearly he was. But I like Jim's thought pattern. I mean, that's not a bad idea. Maybe that's where the outcry was actually coming from. Maybe he was the one that was praying to the Lord. Hey, do something about these people. But the fact of the matter is, the New Testament tells us he was righteous, even though his character is, at best, you know, a weak faith in terms of what he does. But there is a righteousness and a faith to him. So, in verses 10 and 11, Lot, the man of nine lives, is rescued again. I mean, this guy must have part cat in him, right? Seems like every time he gets somewhere, he's fought. Now, what does 11 tell us about Lot's guests? How do we really learn about the character of his guests? Right, they ain't human, okay? They're more than mere men, right? So these are clearly supernatural people. These are the angels that had come with the Lord's presence back in chapter 18. And so we leave verses 1 to 11 with no question about the character of Sodom and its habits and its inhabitants, okay? So the first thing that gets established here in the first 11 verses is that indeed it is as corrupt as the outcry that God has been hearing about it, okay? So should be a reminder that we can't live in close proximity to sin and not be tainted by it, right? I mean, it's a pretty simple lesson.
Just a quick question. I noticed, is there any possibility he may have known that they weren't men? Because I was just noticing the text that it said he baked bread without yeast.
Right. Yeah, I don't think he knew at first, but I think as the story progresses, it became very clear. You'll see actually, I can't remember which verse it is, but he changes from the plural to the singular, which means he's attributing all this to the Lord. So Lot catches on as we go through the process. The unleavened bread was just the normal pattern, I think,
okay,
for quick bread. Yeah, so I don't think that gives us...
included in the scripture, you baked it without yeast.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things there that the Jews were
trying
to do. Yeast was a sign of sin.
Yeah, but also without yeast, you can cook bread what, ladies? Quickly, yeah, a lot faster. Okay, so I think that's really all that's going on there, right? Didn't have to wait for it to rise, pound it back down, let it rise again, bake it. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, we do see that later.
I'll leave all that stuff because I don't know anything
about. We'll let you off the hook on that. We'll give you the man pass on that one. Okay, so somebody read verses 12 to 22 for me. Bobby's son's going to read for us. That'd be good. Man, you guys are timid this morning. Let's go. Bobby.
Yes, sir. Genesis 19, verse 12. Then the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place, because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city." But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. And as they brought them out, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords. Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved." He said to him, "Behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar.
Okay, so second section here, Act 2, we're going to see Lot's deliverance, okay? And this is going to proceed in three parts. First, God's going to divulge his plans. then Lot's going to dilly-dally along, right? And then Lot's going to dicker for more. So we see kind of a funny guy. See how you can alliterate these things? I spend hours trying to figure out what these words are. Tells you a little bit about what my days are like. But it is interesting. I mean, he divulges his plan, he dilly-dallies along, and then he dickers for more. I mean, it's just amazing in the process, okay? We see this through the whole process. Now, God's plan has two objectives, okay? What are they? What are the two objectives of God's plan? Exactly, okay? He's going to rescue the righteous and he's going to destroy the unrighteous, okay? So he's going to destroy what he intended to destroy and he's going to protect the righteous in the process. So this is where we get all these nice perseverance kind of passages in the New Testament. Christ is going to hold on to everybody that the Lord gives him, okay? So we see that. Now, what bigger picture plan does that bring to mind? His preserving the righteous and destroying the unrighteous. Yeah, I mean, the end times, it's God's whole plan for redemption, right? He's going to redeem some, and he's going to destroy others. And we see that, we're going to see that in the tribulation period. We're going to see that in the final judgment, okay? So we see that as kind of a pattern of how God's going to do things. Now, verse 13 reveals the reasons for God's actions. So what do we learn about God in verses 12 and 13? What do we learn about him?
He's compassionate.
Ah, okay. That's a good one. Yeah, he's compassionate. What else?
We already talked about his righteousness. He can't tolerate sin.
Yeah, okay. All right, so we see a bunch of things, right? He doesn't do things capriciously, right? He is compassionate. I didn't have that on my list. I think that's a good one. He gives ample warning before he acts, right? This is kind of plays into God's long-suffering nature. He wants us to know how he's going to accomplish his purposes. I mean, God tells us how to be saved, doesn't he? Pretty clear. Not too hard to figure out, right? And he wants us to understand why he does what he does, okay? So, you know, God's not just some capricious, you know, unreachable, untouchable, unknowable thing. He wants us to know who he is in the whole process. So, Lot changes, this is where I'd mention, Jim, Lot changes here the we of 13 to the Lord in verse 14. So I think this is where it has dawned on him specifically, okay, this is the Lord here, you know, I'm dealing with God in this process. Now, there's a profound principle in verse 14. There's really profound principle. And what is it? So Lot went out, spoke to his sons who were to marry his daughters and said, "Up, get out of this place. For the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-laws to be jesting. So what's the principle here? What's an important principle? His sons-in-law think he's jesting. What does that say about Lot? Okay? When you look like the world, you lose your testimony. Okay? They thought he was joking. Ah, oh, come on, Pop. You're crazy. It's not happening. Right? When you look like the world, you lose your testimony. Now, I came across one commentator who I said it, I just thought it was perfect. It was so simple. If you want to reach the lost, you have to be different. Not the same. Different. Right? Now, think about that quote in light of the way the church is going today. Think about it for a minute, right? I told you I've been reading Martin Lloyd-Jones's biography, which is like 1,200 pages. It's a big book, a little teeny print too. It's probably 2,400 pages. They just squeezed it in with little print. I mean, and he was remarkable. I mean, you read that, and this is back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, same stuff going on in England that we're dealing with here, right, in America. But think about the church's approach today, right? What does the church think, in many cases, we have to do to reach the lost? Be like them. Let's have a good party. Let's put on a good show. Let's not be too mean when we talk about things in the pulpit. So look, when you hear what you hear from the pulpit in this church, when you hear the teaching, you know, it's literally simply just what the text says, okay? That's all they're trying to do when they stand up there. they want to hold to the primacy of Scripture. And this is interesting, to go back to Lloyd-Jones in this whole process, the church was falling apart in England at this point in time. The churches were dwindling, and the Westminster Chapel was exploding, right? And the whole simple point was that what he did week after week after week is he got up and he opened up the Bible and he preached the word. Okay? So the point is, we don't save people by being like them, right? I mean, there's a couple crazy examples, right? So he used to be an alcoholic, so what I'm going to do is go hang out in bars and drink with guys to, you know, to save them. Or maybe I was involved in the adult industry and I'm going to go hang out and do those things because I'm going to reach them that way. I don't think so. I mean, I know my old friends were watching me like a hawk when I first said I'd become a Christian. They were just waiting to see whether or not it was genuine. That's all they wanted to see. Now, of course, they don't talk to me anymore. That's okay. But the fact of the matter is, they found out it was genuine. Now, it was a progression, like everybody, and all of us were sanctified as we go through our walk. But the fact of the matter is, if we want to attract the world, we don't act like and behave like the world. We've got to be different. Right? Why would they want what we have to offer if we're not any different? All right? Deep down, they know they got a problem. But the point of the fact is, we're not acting differently enough. And so, even in the church community here, you know, and Mark bears this burden. The other guys don't bear it nearly as much as the lead pastor of the church. I mean, he gets invited to all kinds of ecumenical kind of stuff. And he quietly and politely demurs from doing it. And what do? Oh, that church, they don't do anything. They don't participate. It's like, look, brother, how can I participate with you if you have fundamental theological beliefs that don't line up with Scripture? We're not gonna smirch our witness. Now, we're not trying to be separatists. We're not trying to be, you know, oh, we're not going to go to your party because it's not our football, right? But the fact of the matter is, you know, the ecumenical movement in the church is challenging, right? It's like, well, we're just going to agree on the essentials. Well, who decides what the essentials are? So the fact of the matter is, I've spent way too much time in this slide, but I just thought it was a great quote, right? So
I haven't read it yet. There was just a statement put out by, the only name I can think of is John MacArthur signed it.
Yeah.
And it has to do with social justice.
Yeah.
And it goes to the point you're saying that so many churches are starting to, well, we have to accept this and that and the other thing. And, you know, they strongly came out with this statement. Basically.
It's all MacArthur. I mean, 5 years ago, what was it? Strange Fire, going after the charismatic movement, and he's going about again. I mean, I admire this guy. He must just have shoulders that are just huge. But it's the social gospel, social justice. We're seeing it all over the Christian community today. And, you know, it started, and I won't get into it. Take us too long. Okay, scene two. Lot dilly-dallies. Okay, Lot dilly-dallies, 15 and 16, right? 15 is really quite emphatic. It says, you know, two imperatives. And Bobby caught it in his reading. Up! Get out of here! Okay, these are imperatives, commands. Get going. Reason why, lest you be swept away. Now, this is the same Hebrew verb used in Abraham's appeal back in chapter 18, which I think is just another way to tell us that he's making it clear that he is responding to Lot's request, or to Abraham's request, to protect the righteous in the process. Now, how does Lot respond to the angel's command? How does he respond?
He hesitates,
right? He dilly-dallies, right? How about, so what does it tell us about him? Okay, he's a double-minded man, right? What does James say about that? You're unstable in all your ways. In Chinese, they have a little idiom that when they talk about a double-minded man, they say he steps into two boats, right? So you got one leg in one boat and one leg in the other boat. You know, whoa, you're jumping around. Some of the idioms are really good. They're very literal. But, you're stepping into two boats. You're a double-minded man, all right? So what did Jesus and James say about this man? As I already said, you can't serve two masters, right? Jesus says that pretty clearly in Matthew 6:24, right? Because you're going to what? Love one and hate the other. Okay, so you can't be. And then, of course, James in 1:8 says he's unstable in all his ways, right? So, double-minded man. Now, what's the proper corrective for this kind of response? You know, if you're a double-minded man, what does Jesus go on to say in that Sermon on the Mount? Seek first the kingdom, Okay, and what? What comes after that? And you get all the good stuff, right? Seek first his kingdom and all these things will be provided for you. Okay, so you see the similar pattern. So what's the source of God's actions in verse 16? What's the source of his actions? You said it earlier, Linda.
His mercy.
Yeah, his mercy, his compassion. Okay, so back to Andre and the fairness, we see it working itself out in his mercy, okay, in his compassion, right? Even though Abram appealed to God's justice, it's working itself out through God's mercy, okay? So that's what the process is. Scene 3, Lot dickers in verses 17 to 22. Again, verse 17 is a strong command, so he's urging him, escape, instructions, don't look back, don't stop. Destination, to the hills, head for the hills. Reason, lest you be swept away. So again, this whole process, he's indicating that, yes, he's honoring what Abraham had asked him for so they don't get swept away. Now, when he says go to the hills, what do you think the destination is that he might be suggesting?
That it was going to be destroyed as well?
No, this is the safe place, okay? So go to the hills. So where do you think this would be? So think of Sodom, where it is.
Back to Abraham,
okay? He's directing him back to Abraham, all right? So, Lot's no prodigal, right? Instead of humility, he exhibits selfish arrogance, right? No, I'm not going back there. Not subjecting myself to that guy. I'm going to keep doing my own stuff. So, verses 18 to 20 are classic high-context communication. So in the West, right, basically pretty much we have WYSIWYG. What you say is what you get, right? So we have low-context communication. Now in the East, it is hilarious to communicate. So all you guys that bemoan male-female communication, let me just add to that Eastern and Western communication. And the greatest news about that is most times that we're arguing, we're not even talking about the same thing. So therefore, it results in laughter and humor, which gets us out of it pretty quickly. But the fact of the matter is, in Eastern communication, and probably, I suspect, a bit in Russian communication, there's a lot of context. They kind of talk around what they want, and they expect the hearer to properly interpret, right? You're bobbing your head. Is that right, Nicholas? Okay, so they don't say things directly. Okay, so it's classic high context communication, right? Lot is not making an appeal, a genuine appeal for his physical ability, is he? You mean you can't walk to the hills? Come on. Okay, he's dickering, right? So verse 18 with an explanation, oh no, not this. So I'm thinking, well, how about just a simple thank you? Yeah, I'll head for the hills, no problem. No, not Lot. Okay, it's not enough that God's going to save him. He's looking for a better deal. So verse 19 starts the process, right? What's he say? He recognizes he's the beneficiary of grace and kindness, okay? So he does recognize that, hey, I'm getting a special deal here, which again, right, when God preserves you and you get a special deal, usually pretty much, I think the simple response would be, thank you, okay? But no, not Lot, right? Here's the but. Okay, so do you really think his reason is genuine? I've already given you the answer. I don't. But it is ironically prophetic, right? Why does he not want to go to the hills? What's he say? Yeah, he says, what else is up there? Evil. It's right there. Just read it. Evil will overtake him in the hills. So he is a little prophetic, isn't he? Right? Evil is indeed going to overtake him when he finally ends up going to the hills, ironically. Right? He said, no, I'm not going to go there, but where does he end up? In the hills. How does the whole story end up? Disgrace. Okay, so you have the process there. So, verse 20, he supplies the alternative. How about this small city close by, God? So, I mean, he doesn't have any compulsion about presuming upon God, right? He's given me something. Well, I might as well ask for more. I'm getting what I want so far. It's only a small one. Surely you can preserve that. Okay, now this city, Zoar, if you go back to the event of the kings of the east and the west fighting, it was one of the five cities. So clearly, I think it was intended to be part of what God was going to bring down fire and brimstone on. So seems to have no conscience about testing God's patience. and he still seems to be having trouble letting go, right? He kind of wants to kind of get away, but yeah, I want to kind of keep my finger in the pot, okay? Kind of hang on to things. So remarkably, Lot's request is granted. This city is named Zoar, which means little or insignificant in Hebrew. And as I said a minute ago, this was part of the rebellious king, so I do suspect this is probably one of the cities that God intended to destroy. So we do see that for whatever reason, he's sending the righteous there, right? So he's not going to destroy, he is going to spare that city because there is one righteous, or two or three, because of his daughter. So you kind of see this kind of whole big mix of how God's working these things out. Again, like I've always said, his Rubik's Cube is way more than three dimensions, right? He's just got colors everywhere and he's figuring it all out. Yet for the sake of Lot, to honor his promise, he spares Zoar. Now, what's interesting about verse 22? What's interesting about verse 22?
God won't let him destroy anything until Lot and his family are safe where they're supposed to be.
Exactly right. So what's that beginning to hint at? Okay, go ahead. Hints at some idea of preservation or assurance. Okay, so people can't act against God's people until God says it's okay. Right? So kind of interesting, right? Our hands are tied until you get out of here. So we see kind of some initial hints of these later doctrines of preservation or assurance here. But the angel's hands are tied until we get there. Jesus says this repeatedly in the New Testament, right? Okay, he's going to protect everybody that the Lord has given to him. So Lot, despite his shortcomings, is preserved by God. And we're probably going to have to stop here because I got to, well, let's just go. Let's see if we can get 23 to 29. Somebody read that. I'll read it since you guys are going to do it. 23. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now Abraham rose early in the morning and went out to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of the furnace. Thus it came about, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities of Lot, cities in which Lot lived. Okay, so I'm going to quickly zip through these. So Act 3, we're going to see the actual destruction. Now this is the picture of God's retributive justice. Remember, remunerative justice for good behavior, retributive for disobedience, punishment for disobedience. Plays out in two levels, corporately on the cities and on the inhabitants. Okay. So these coveted fields that Lot first saw are now diminished to a wasteland in the process. Now, it's all kind of speculation about, you know, where this stuff came from and was it volcanoes erupting and this and this and this. I have no idea what it did. All I know is he just did bad stuff and burned it all up. Okay? That's what the text says. What's that?
It's still like that.
It's still like that today. Exactly correct. And this is why I call it a monument to God's justice. You look at that, you see what God does on the wicked, individually on the supposed righteous. Abraham arises early the next day to see God's verdict, and he observes the totality of God's judgment on Sodom. Okay, now, Abraham doesn't really know what's happened to Lot at this point in time, right? He hasn't been clued in, but yet I find it interesting what is notable about Abraham's response. What's notable about his response? Does he complain? Does he object? Okay. Factly, what's notable about his response is there is none. Right? He just solemnly looks at it and doesn't say a word. Right? He looks at it and doesn't say a word. So he's working this out in his head, right? Maybe he was thinking, along with the writer of Hebrews, that it's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But the fact of the matter is, there's no outrage with Abraham, and again, this is just my speculation, because he rested peacefully, in that God did what needed to be done. So he did his part, he appealed, he probed God's mind, he tried to understand. God did his part. So there's no record in the Bible that Abraham ever reunited with Lot, or that he knew what happened to Lot. But basically the Lot story ends here, well, it ends in the next few verses, and it's the last that we hear of Lot in the Bible. Okay? So, how does Act 3 end? With this reaffirmation of God's righteousness and God's justice. So again, even though Abraham may have been wondering, we're told that, look, God was both righteous and just in what he did. And we can rely on those things. Okay? So, we're going to stop here. We'll pick it up. He protected the righteous, not in the manner he did. So we will pick it up in the final verses next week, and then maybe we'll get totally in sync with the other case. Larry, would you close us up in a word of prayer, please?
I would. Thank you. Our gracious Heavenly Father, what a wonderful testimony of the great, of your greatness and your promises and the word we've heard today. And Father, we do pray that our